the way from Marin County. I have some idea of what I'm going to talk about tonight, but most of it inspired by just sitting with you and remembering that I was here a few weeks ago, or about 10 days ago, leading a day-long retreat, and some of the different questions and conversations that arose during that time inspired some reflection. And the first poem that came to my mind that will somewhat relate to some of the things that we talked about is a poem from Rumi. Rumi is an often read, inspiring, ecstatic Sufi poet who clearly spoke from an awakened consciousness. And so this particular poem speaks to all of us, I think, and directly addresses the issue of making choices. And this is what I'd like to talk about tonight, to some degree. This poem goes, "Failure is the key to the kingdom within. Your prayer should be, break the legs of what I want to happen. Humiliate my desire. Eat me like candy. It's spring, and finally I have no will." How does that make you feel when you hear that? In my own experience and practice and study of the Dharma, it seems that this question of making choices is the most frequently asked one. Have any of you noticed that? Have any of you noticed that in your own mind? No one has that question. The question of how do we make choices, wise choices, skillful choices. And this, it begs the question, which is really at the heart of the liberation of the Buddha specifically, and of course across other wisdom traditions, the question of who or what makes choices. Isn't that true? Isn't that at the heart of what we're practicing? To find out who, as the Buddha declared on the night of his awakening, who is the maker of this house? He says, "Oh, house builder, you've been seen. You won't build another house again." And then he goes on to say, "Rafters of the ridge destroyed, the mind gone to the unconditioned, to cravings or graspings destruction it has come." So something about the teaching and something related to making choices revolves around this question of who chooses, what chooses. And from the conventional point of view that most of us find ourselves thinking in each day, we are individual entities in our minds feeling as though we exist somehow apart from the flow of life. Have you noticed that at all? Like that metaphor that's used in the Hindu tradition a lot, like a wave we are, like a wave that has arisen on the ocean, a unique wave, but somehow in our uniqueness, in our, you might say, arrogance or our self-absorption, we think individually that we are that one wave who's somehow gotten separated from the ocean. Not realizing, forgetting, overlooking that we are immersed in the very thing that we've been searching for. Because, of course, the wave that feels that he or she is separate from the ocean then starts meditating and says, "I'm going to find my way back to the ocean." And the open secret of the teachings and all the pointing that you hear over and over to this moment is the reminder that you are immersed in the very thing you're searching for. You are one and the same as the ocean. You are completeness itself, contentment itself. Only your mind has the habit of going out of itself in search, has the habit of believing, of thinking that it's a wave that's gotten separated from the ocean. So this is where we find ourselves here tonight, thinking that we're waves that have gotten separated from the ocean. And as long as we think we are waves, fixated in the conventional viewpoint of ourselves as separate individuals existing apart from the flow of life, as long as we're in that particular point of view, you could say that we are beings of very narrow perspective. And the direction of self-inquiry, the direction of meditation practice, is, you could say, the whole of one's practice is simply a move from that narrow, self-centered perspective, just about me and mine and how I'm going to get back to that ocean, moving from that self-centered perspective to a wider, open, receptive point of view that begins to quite naturally, without necessarily deliberately thinking about it, quite naturally begins to move to a consideration of the universal, the myriad beings that all share this this existence, this time of aliveness that we all share, this 100 or less years where we have that we get to taste that living presence and be conscious of it and to utilize this life. So this seems to be the direction. And as long as we are in a what you might call a narrow point of view or a narrow perspective, it's really hard to make decisions. Have you noticed? It's not so easy to make decisions when you are relating to yourself as the person who's separate from life. When you're relating to yourself through the lens of your thinking, the lens of your story, your internal narrative that suggests in some way, some shape or form, that you are, that there's something wrong. There's often a feeling that there's something wrong. There's often a feeling of anxiety, worry. There's a feeling of a lack of safety. There's a feeling of fear. There's often a feeling that not only is there something wrong, but there's something wrong with me. Have you noticed? Once this something wrong with me takes root and is practiced, it's conditioned in our hearts and minds, that feeling, the body forms, the body takes a shape around those particular thoughts and feelings. And our hearts tighten, our bellies tighten. I know for me, I carry that sometimes a certain kind of tension in my thighs, and I can feel that sense of self-consciousness in the thigh area or in the heart or in the belly. And this self-consciousness should be distinguished, differentiated from the functional sense of our beingness, the functional sense of speaking, of hearing, of smelling, of tasting, of just moving through life, of singing, of all the things that happen quite naturally, that can happen quite naturally without having to have a little story running the whole time. That functional selfing is a part of taking birth, a part of being a human being. It's so natural to each of us. But it's that excessive selfing. It's that compulsion. The word in Pali for, you probably heard the word kilesa a lot. Have you ever heard that word kilesa? It's loosely translated as torments of the mind. Those tendencies of mind that continually spin and lead us to feel that things are not okay. In some ways, a more accurate translation is compulsion. It's that compulsion to think, and then the worry and the, all the feelings that go with it. Once this takes root, then the present moment, the place where we're sitting, here and now, at least the place where we think we're sitting here and now, feels like not the place that we're looking for. It feels, this present moment feels like a place of torment in some way. Because what we've left from so much worry, so much anxiety, we've left a legacy of tension in our bodies. And we've started to live a lot, as I know Gil uses this expression a lot, start to live a lot in virtual reality. And virtual reality is that reality that's usually bound in some way in thoughts of time, thoughts of past, thoughts of present, thoughts of future. And once there's this acknowledgement, this internal story that says there's something wrong and there's something wrong with me, I'm that wave that's gotten separated from the ocean, immediately the mind starts strategizing. Have any of you noticed? We have this concept called the project mentality, the strategizing mind. It's that sense that if I work it out just right, if I work out all of my problems, if I do enough therapy, if I go to enough retreats, if I can get my mind to quiet down, if I can get my body to open up doing enough yoga, then someday I will be that wave that has found its way back to the ocean. And the yearning to be back immersed in the ocean seems so natural, doesn't it? It's the yearning to end all yearnings. But the very yearning, when it takes the shape of a lot of compulsive thinking and compulsive strategizing and planning, becomes another incarnation, you could say. It becomes another place in our minds where we take birth as the one who's not okay. And instead of our practice of meditation, our practice of self-inquiry, our jobs, our creative projects, instead of them bringing relief, they tend to simply increase the sense that the best is yet to come. Increase the sense that I'm still not quite back immersed in the thing that I've been searching for. I'm still one step behind, or one step away from happiness. Any of you feel that at all? What's that? Amen. So I know I'm preaching to the choir, but you know, I'm talking to myself as well. So then what happens to our plans? We talked about this on this weekend retreat. What happens to our plans, our jobs, our choices for what we will do next? They become burdened. They become so heavy with the demand that they have to make us happy. They have to give us relief. And that's a setup. That's the cause and condition for us to feel more and more anxious. Because then, of course, as you probably all thought about before, the future becomes the source of happiness. And it's so easy to forget that the future doesn't exist. The time is only now. In fact, you can't even find time if we look directly on present evidence. It requires a certain entering into thinking of memory or of plans, worries, whatever. Otherwise, there's only this now, as Alan Watts says. It's one of the things you recognize when you stop thinking for a moment. There's only this present moment, only this eternal now. He suggests that what we need to do is groove with the present, to dig the eternal now, to realize that where it's at is simply here and now. So someone asked me last week, this is kind of a prelude to how to make choices. Someone asked me last week, I have the hardest time making choices. And now there's this question of whether I'm going to buy a new condominium or not. And I just can't figure out how to make this decision. And I saw him coming because I've heard this question before. And what I said, whether it was the right answer or not, I'll never know. But I said, first and foremost, for me, in my own inquiry about how to make choices, I have to know with confidence, with conviction, that what I'm truly searching for, because obviously most of us are searching for the hidden aim in everything that we're doing is to find some relief, some contentment, some happiness, that I must have conviction that that contentment or happiness is the nature of my being. And that it is not conditioned, not dependent on whether I make the right decision or the wrong decision. That I must know with a real sense of home, that I'm already home, that I'm already immersed in the thing that I'm searching for. That there's nothing fundamentally, no decision that I make, no place that I can go, no person that I can be with, no thing in this world of change that will fundamentally make me happier than I am. Now, things will make me in a better mood or not, but this is not what we're talking about, contentment, completeness. This is not what the Buddha talked about when he talked about happiness. He talked about the happiness of the unconditioned. He talked about the happiness of not being anyone in particular, going someplace. The happiness of being. The gratitude for being, like Walt Whitman, where he says, I'm grateful for what I am and have. My thanksgiving is perpetual. It's strange how contented one can be with nothing definite, only a sense of existence. Oh, how I laugh at my vague, indefinite riches, for no run on my bank can drain it. Is your happiness that unconditioned? For no run on my bank can drain it, for my happiness is... I have to start over, otherwise I'll never remember. Let's see if I can start over, because you probably want to hear it anyway. I'm grateful for what I am and have. My thanksgiving is perpetual. It's strange how contented one can be with nothing definite, only a sense of existence. Oh, how I laugh at my vague, indefinite riches. For no run on my bank can drain it. For my wealth is not possession, but enjoyment, enjoyment of being. The happiness of the Buddha being called the happy one, as everyone may know or not know, not the sufferer, but the happy one, the great sufferer, was the happiness of being free of hunger, free of that longing to get somewhere else. The happiness of that doesn't depend on getting what you want or not wanting what you get. That pervades even those times where it's really unpleasant, with a knowledge that this is how it is. That whatever it is that arises has the nature to arise, has the nature to pass away. And that's all that Buddhas know, is that whatever arises passes away. just like that sound. This sense of the unconditioned, or Lokuttara Sukha, as the Buddha called it. I was reminded when we were sitting tonight, you know, the traffic goes by, the train goes by, and it's very easy. You know, maybe you have a comparing mind for where you sat before. Did anybody compare to the old place? Or is that already done with? You found the Buddha within this place as well. Well, anyway, it reminded me of a time when I was in Burma, and I went there with the express intention of finding Lokuttara Sukha, you know, finding that happiness that didn't depend on conditions. And oh my God, I was so dependent on conditions, I couldn't believe it. But the conditions were intense. The first day, I landed in a room that was bug infested, hot. I had to sit, do my meditation practice under a mosquito net. Steamy, had to take cold bucket showers about 7 or 8 times a day just to stay cool. Sitting in my room, finding the Buddha within, very quickly, metal on metal, rebar construction, all day long, pounding in the outside the window to my room. Madonna rocking and rolling as a Burmese woman was smacking her laundry on the rocks to clean it and dry it or whatever. Loudspeakers, literally 24 hours a day. Burma is a country with the, even though it's the most repressive, one of the most repressive countries in the world, it's also a country with the most festivals of any country in the world. And the festivals with the different, you know, it's predominantly a Buddhist country, but there are Hindus, there are Muslims, there are Christians, and they compete with each other with the sound of the loudspeakers. So this is what was going on. And at a certain point, there is no longer, and this was not a high experience at this time, there was no longer an inside or an outside. This was not transcendent. It was just impossible to tell. So if my sense of well-being, if that sense of home was dependent on having conditions how I imagined that they would need to be, I was in big trouble. And you can imagine in your own life what conditions you think have to be different in order to find that sense of home. Whatever they are, this is as good as it gets. Like the line in the movie. What if this, when Jack Nicholson walks into the therapist's office and sees everyone sitting like us and says, "What if this is as good as it gets?" It's interesting, isn't it, to live life that way? What happens if for a moment in the span of life we stop looking for the sweet one, as Mullah Nasruddin often talks about? Some would say space is there, open, inviting, comfortable. So the key, seems to me, from my own experience, is if there is some degree, if I've discovered, and I have some increasing confidence in this, if I have some sense that I don't need to move from this spot to find relief, I don't need to rearrange all the conditions of my life. I don't have to jump through every hoop. I don't have to collect experiences. I don't have to go everywhere. Even though it's fine to go everywhere, it's fine to do everything. But if I know inwardly that I don't have to move to feel a sense of relief, it takes a huge amount of anxiety about whether a decision is the right one or not. then I can go about making decisions, actually have fun, do lots of things, but without the demand and the expectation that they have to make me happy. Because it is the pursuit of the excessive egoic self, that we create in our own mind, not the natural functioning of our being, but it is in the nature of that excessive selfing that... Well, I forgot what I was going to say. Who forgot? Say that again.
I know, I'm just thinking you lose track of something, but I don't know.
It seems that it's in the nature of that excessive selfing to forget. I find it so interesting to having experimented with the notion that what I truly am is not nameable or describable. What I truly am, although functionally and conventionally a human being who has history and memory and hopes and dreams and family and this and that, but at the fundamental nature of my being, I am not nameable or describable. And when I practice that, when I have confidence in that, and I see this as the same as what I'll call trusting awareness, trusting that sense of just being present and knowing what's happening, that when I stay where I am, trust the unfolding of things, don't enter that rapid, rolling, momentous stream of becoming, which is what the mind does when it creates the sense of self. Have you noticed that feeling of becoming? That feeling of toppling forward? That feeling of obsessing about what's next? When that can be shed in moments at a time, moment after moment after moment after moment, and awareness can be trusted and the present moment can be trusted with an understanding that the future, because it's unborn, will take care of itself, that all the functioning, all the natural functioning of creativity, of decision-making, of speaking, reflecting, all the functions that are natural to being human work, as I like to say, 200% better. And that there is a sense that there is fundamentally no decider. Decisions are made, but no one who decides. Spoken words arise, but no one who speaks them. And that is, for me, that selfless, that unselfing process, that shedding of the sense of doership, the shedding of the decider, is the key to the kingdom within. That poem speaks of. I'll recite it again. Failure is the key to the kingdom within. Your prayer should be, break the legs of what I want to happen, humiliate my desire, eat me like candy. It's spring, and finally I have no will. There's something about that no will, even for a moment in the span of life, life as good as it gets, it seems out of that comes wise choice, a wider sense of being, not that narrow, self-absorbed, self-fixated sense of being. And at least in my own experience of this, in trusting awareness, trusting the unfolding of things, the nature of choices, the nature of the choices that I've made, the choice or that I make or are made, I can say, kind of you have to use language, but otherwise you'll drive everybody crazy. But the nature of the choices that are made from this place of being are naturally more altruistic, much more considerate of the wider implications of what I might decide, whether it's not just good for me, but it has to be somehow good for other beings. I'm more sensitive to the impact of what I do. That's why I often say, just consider when you practice, when you spend a practice period with yourself, that you consider having as a motivation for your practice that at least, if not for all beings, because that may seem too large to think of, but at least for the people who have to live around you every day. Because we're constantly impacting. And this naturally is seen when our eyes are open and we're not busy being somebody, not busy being a meditator even, but so open, receptive, tuned. Now, there's many ways to discover that life's happening anyway, whether you think you're deciding or not. Decisions are happening whether you think you're the one behind them. Many ways of discovering that. The Buddha spoke in discourses about the path of meditation, about carefully examining mind and body, noticing, seeing in that process of sensations, of different ideas, the voices of Mara that constantly say you're not okay, noticing that if there's any place in this mind and body that you can say, this is me, this is mine, this is what or who I am. And in the very careful and gradual process of meditation, at least in his case and in many, many people's, it's why we take refuge in the Sangha, those who have actually paid attention to this and put the teachings to practice and realized the truth of selflessness, that we can draw inspiration from that. But that's one way. Another way that's taught in many other traditions is the direct approach, the direct cutting through of our illusion of self. It's to, in this very moment, to suspend for a moment the idea of who you take yourself to be that seems to be tethered to thoughts. And for a moment, sense the sound of this voice and turn directly. See, what is it that hears that? What is it that senses the body sitting here? What is it that feels sad or happy? Now we say, I feel sad or happy. What is that I in this moment? What is that? And to keep that inquiry going until you can shout your song of realization, your song of liberation like the Buddha did. I might have that song that I might have it with me tonight, and if we're lucky, I do. Here, I do. Great. This is the Buddha after his awakening. Through many births. Now, in this case, when you hear the word births, consider it not just the birth of, you know, of this body. Think of it the birth that you take every moment in the thoughts that you have about yourself. Each one of those thoughts of self is a birth. And that once there's birth, then there's the whole process, there's the cycle of birth, sickness, old age, and death. Now that happens every moment that thought arises and we jump on the train and we become that. We think that that's who we are. So that's last bit of the commentary. Through many births, in the wandering on, I ran, seeking but not finding the maker of this house. Dukkha, suffering, dissatisfaction, insufficiency, is birth again and again. Housemaker, you've been seen. You shall not make a house again. All your beams are broken up, rafters of the ridge destroyed, the mind gone to the unconditioned, to craving's destruction or cessation it has come. So every moment that we return again to this sense of presence, not being anyone in particular being present, but simply openness, we return to the unconditioned. We erase a bit of craving, a bit of becoming. And out of this sense of presence, out of this present awareness, all life unfolds much more effortlessly. Decisions are made, some right, some wrong, but each of us can remain still. And as Ajahn Chah often says, this is the happiness of the Buddha. So it's about that time. So let's just sit for a few moments. From the poet Hafiz, just sit there. Just sit there right now. Don't do a thing. Just rest. For your separation from God is the hardest work in the world. Let me bring you trays of food and something that you like to drink. You can use my soft words as a cushion for your head. Since I don't come here often, I'm inclined to ask if there are any comments or questions for a couple minutes, if anyone is not too eager to go somewhere where you'll be happier. Please. How do you open to the, say the first part again?
To the notion that there is no decider. And yet still have a sense that you're taking responsibility for the choices you make.
Yeah, taking responsibility for the choices that you make comes naturally out of seeing clearly what's being chosen and what the results are of choices being made. So let's skip the non-dual language, and let's talk about, okay, I'm present. The more I'm present, the more I can see what happens when I make certain choices. If I make certain choices that cause me more suffering, I have to deal with that, whether I like it or not. So taking responsibility for that is simply to be willing to be aware and to see what the truth is that happens. That is a natural function of awareness. In the Tibetan tradition, the word awareness and wisdom are synonymous. That when there's awareness, there's a discernment about what works and what doesn't, and what causes suffering, what doesn't. And to know that and to be open to that as it is to me the same as taking responsibility. You may mean something else by that, I'm not sure.
No, that makes sense.
Okay. Please. Say that what? Which one?
Wasn't it a Rumi poem at the beginning?
Oh, at the beginning.
Last spring.
Failure is the key to the kingdom within. Your prayer should be, break the legs of what I want to happen. Humiliate my desire. Eat me like candy. It's spring, and finally I have no will. This goes very against our normal, go get it. You know, I just went to the Olympics for a few days, which was quite thrilling. And it would be very easy to attribute a lot of self to the people who are doing those sports and those different exercises. But I have a feeling when they're immersed in their activity, they're not thinking about themselves. And it is possible for all of us to function so much better if we're not so caught in our compulsive story, that we actually do things quite well. And see, that was to me one of the great inspirations of seeing these athletes just completely let go into their event. Didn't seem egoic at all. Please.
I have a question about how you relate what you're speaking about tonight to parenting, in terms of not making decisions for yourself, but making decisions for a child or somebody else.
To me, all level of decisions, especially ones with children, even though I don't have children, that's where the natural functioning of that we quite naturally make wiser decisions if we're open and present. And that especially with children are like, in a sense, like difficult events. Children demand that we're present. And so that they're great teachers, if we use them as such, to align us with being present. You cannot be busy thinking about yourself again and make, you know, wise choices for your children. How, and if you are not thinking about yourself, I think you'd actually you'd probably do really well. So anything that, this is, it all sounds a little vague right now, but anything that you can do to erase the dust of memory, to let the clear mirror of your mind be present, you know, anything, any moment of awareness does not go, it's not wasted. So that's why I keep saying trust awareness. Okay. Well, thank you all very much. And thank you in advance for your generosity. I drove all the way from Marin County. Just kidding. Anyway, thanks again.